check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
While COVID and war captured world attention, Arctic wildfires are accelerating. 44% of Arctic burns in the last 40 years came in the last 3 years. The pace is accelerating, and scientists warn the Arctic is approaching a new tipping point that could push more warming on the whole world. The paper is Unprecedented Fire Activity Above the Arctic Circle Linked to Rising Temperatures. A major author is forest mapping expert Dr. David Gaveau. He has published over 60 papers and appears regularly in the media and advises NGOs and has been part of the UN process at times. From France, David Gaveau, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, hello, Alex. Thank you for having me.
First of all, most people picture the Arctic as a treeless waste of ice and snow. Where are the forests then?
You've got taiga forests growing quite far north. Then the tree line starts to, the further north you go, the tree line starts to shorten and eventually disappears. And then we're entering a tundra biome. Our work focused on an area of Siberia above the Arctic Circle. So we call that the Siberian Arctic, an area about 5.5 times larger than the size of France. So perhaps the size of Western Europe, a little bit more. So I would say that most of this area is tundra and less taiga forests, although there is some. But really, what we're looking at here is fires on tundra grasslands, although a little bit also in forested regions further south.
Very little credible news and analysis gets out of Russian Siberia. How did your team estimate the increase in fires?
Right, so we were alarmed by the results when we found them. We are satellite people, and we've been monitoring forest fires, essentially burned areas, you know, the area of land that burns by fire. We've used satellites in various regions of the world, primarily working on Indonesia, and we sort of applied our techniques. We modified them to work out, to measure, to estimate the area of land that burned in the Siberian Arctic every year since 1982. For this, we used various satellite sensors, some of which were already in space in 1980. So we were able to recreate a time series of annual burned areas since 1982 to 2020 using satellites such as Landsat, Sentinel-2, AVHR, and some burned area products derived by NASA using Aqua and Terra satellites. We put all these data sets together. Some images we analyzed ourselves, the Landsat data and the Sentinel data, and we were able to show through this that we see more of the Arctic, of the Siberian Arctic, burning today than ever before. I mean, our window is only looking at 40 years, but in the last 3 years, like nearly half of what actually burned in the last 40 years burned in the last 3 years. That was a shocking result for us because we fear that a tipping point has been reached. I say this because we show that the rapid warming of the Arctic has led to more extreme wildfire seasons. We find that a temperature threshold has been crossed beyond which a small increase in temperature will lead to an exponential increase in the area burned in that region. And in 2019 and 2020, average summer temperatures in the Siberian Arctic have been above 10 degrees Celsius. They were, in fact, I think in 2020, it was nearly 13 degrees Celsius, 12.8 or something, air temperature, summer, June, July, August. And that represented, it was 3 degrees warmer than a typical summer in 1980. The average air temperature in summer, so from June to August, was greater than 10 degrees only 4 times in the period under our study, which starts in 1982, only 4 times in 2001. And then the last 3 years of the study period, 2018, 2019, and 2020. And these 4 years, including 2001, turned out to be the years with the most fires too. So really the Arctic heats up. We know some studies have already shown that the Arctic heats up faster than the rest of the planet. But what we are actually showing is that this amplification is causing abnormal fire activity in the region. And that's worrisome, because this is an area which normally doesn't burn. I wouldn't say that fires are not uncommon, because you do see fire activity every summer, but not on the scales that we've measured. We've measured that 3 million hectares of lands burned in 2020. This is our most accurate measurement using Sentinel-2 satellite imagery from the European Space Agency, a 20-meter spatial resolution. This is as good as it gets to measure burned area over large spatial scales. I'm talking of an area of 286 million hectares, size of Western Europe, a little bit more. 3 million hectares burned in that single year.
For decades, forest experts discounted the role of wildfires as a source of additional carbon and climate change. They said shrubs and trees will return to recapture any carbon they lost. But is it now burning at a rate faster than it can be recaptured by growth?
Well, this is an interesting question, and I actually don't have the answer. The carbon that is obviously, the more fire, the more burning, the more carbon and CO2 and methane are released into the atmosphere. I don't know where it ends. There was an interesting study that did look at the where did the carbon that burned in Australia during the 2019 and 2020. There were massive fires there. And some of that was actually recaptured by blooming phytoplankton somewhere in the ocean. I forgot where it was. I think the paper had actually located that region. So there are mechanisms by which this carbon is going to be sequestered again by nature. So, you know, potentially by blooming algae or phytoplankton in the ocean. But the reason why we think that this result is a worrying result is because the area in this region of the world is covered in, you know, this tundra is essentially a swamp. It's a swamp with rich, the soil is rich in carbon. We're talking of permafrost, we're talking of peatlands, Arctic peatlands. And this frozen permafrost is actually a sink of carbon. It's been, you know, sometimes they can be thousands of years old. They've accumulated carbon over the time because the region is cold, and they can trap and sequester that carbon. But because of the rising temperature, and the Arctic is warming, I think, more than four times faster than the planet as a whole, this warming is impacting this permafrost, which is thawing and drying. And through this, fires do start to occur on those soils, and they release carbon. And obviously, the more burning will happen, the more carbon will be emitted, because there's a lot of carbon stored in that soil. And that's the worry, because what we show might be just the beginning of more and more carbon released into the atmosphere. And then at this point, the question is, you know, will the planetary system be able to capture, re-sequester all this carbon? That I don't know, and perhaps I don't think so. But I think that's the worry across the world. Those carbon sinks, those peatlands have been degraded by human activity. Our work in Indonesia have showed this. In Indonesia, it's a little bit different, because the carbon soils are also swamps, but they're covered in lush tropical forests. And, you know, there's been lots of deforestation. And the swamps have been drained through drainage canals. And as a result, there has been an increase in fire activity on those degraded peatlands, deforested peatlands. You know, essentially carbon sinks, lush tropical forests have been turned into carbon soils, degraded tropical peatlands, degraded and drained. So the story is different, but slightly similar. We are also in the presence of peatlands. There aren't many trees. We're in the tundra, although there might be places where there's forest. But the point is that those peatlands, if they become sources of carbon, this is not good news for our planet, because historically, naturally, nature makes them be carbon sinks. And we go out there and then, you know, we create these disturbances and then they become net emitters of carbon. So that's not good news.
Yes, peat is one of my greater fears, actually. In 1997 and 98, Indonesia became the world's third biggest greenhouse gas emitter just because of peat fires. And you published a study in 2013 on Sumatran peat fires. Have you published maps and papers and all that sort of thing about how much peat there is in the Arctic? Do we know sort of the total threat that's waiting up there?
Well, it's a good question again. And for our work, we show that as well as having more burning each year in the Siberian Arctic, we do see also that more carbon-rich peat soils are burning. We found this map that was published in a paper in PNAS where they were presenting a map with measurements of the carbon content of the peat. As far as I can tell, I think the largest peatlands in Siberia are not in the area that's currently, you know, that's been burning, that we've seen burning. I mean, well, there is some, but the largest share of it is more in western Siberia, a bit at lower latitudes. And as far as I can, we didn't actually look at that region specifically. Essentially, there's a lot of peatlands in Siberia, and you don't want to, you know, we don't want to disturb it. That's as simple as that.
Is your study limited to eastern Siberia in this paper, or would it apply to other locations like the boreal forests of Scandinavia and Canada?
Right. So we chose the region of the Siberian Arctic for a reason. We started off looking at the entire Arctic region, so Greenland, northern Canada, Alaska, and northern Europe, Sweden, Norway, Finland, and Russia. What we found was that the region of the Arctic that historically burns the most is this region in Siberia that we focused on. But I have seen some maps in some recently published papers that tend to show that this is also the region of the Arctic that warms the fastest. But it doesn't mean that as, you know, as we go on into the future, that more of the Arctic will burn and other regions will be impacted. I mean, I do know that there are already fires in Alaska. Fire, again, was, I think it was also published in PNAS not long ago, and they made the predictions that temperature increase would double the area of burning in Alaska compared to the sort of the historical average. Well, we actually confirmed this prediction, but we showed it for the Siberian Arctic, and we showed that it's already doubled, because the paper had predicted that it would double by 2050 in Alaska, and we show that it's already happened in the Siberian Arctic. So it's all going along the same direction. But initially, we've looked at the entire Arctic, and then we said, okay, we'll focus on this region because this is the one that's been burning the most. And we think it's because there's a sort of, it's warming faster than the rest of the Arctic. And I don't quite know why. It's probably due to sort of, you know, atmospheric circulations and so on. But I think that's the case.
Well, as you pointed out, a paper by Mika Rantanen and colleagues revealed the Arctic is warming four times faster than the rest of the world. And that just came out this summer. It's fairly new news. But we also know that wildfires need a source of ignition. Heat is not enough. And there are not as many humans in the Arctic, although Russia has more Arctic settlements than any other country. What is lighting up the northern forests? What starts these fires?
Right. So it's a bunch of things, but what we show in the paper that they're all linked to temperature. So at the end of the day, it's warming, you know, the ultimate cause. When the surface of the land warms, when the air above it warms, we tend to see more water vapor coming off the water surface, coming off the land surface or the surface of the vegetation. Because the water molecules on the surface of the land and the vegetation, they become more excited. They've got more energy, more kinetic energy. So there are more chances for them to be able to break this bond that keeps them attached to the liquid and go out in the air. But also the air temperature above it, because it's warmer, it's expanding. So it's able to hold more water vapor in the air. So this process by which water vapor flows from the surface of the land and vegetation away into the sort of the atmosphere above it is this process of vapor pressure. And as the air warms and the surface temperature warm, we do see that more water vapor is sort of being sucked out of the land surface into the atmosphere. And we are talking of a vapor pressure deficit. So what happens is that the land surface is actually getting drier. But then this water vapor ultimately goes up in the air and it's warmer. So it'll eventually end up, but that's also depending on circulations. And there's this paper that was also published around the same time as ours, talking about polar jets and so on. But so this moist air, this water vapor in the air, eventually will start to condensate and to form thunderstorms, and there'll be lightning. And what we're essentially showing is that this rising temperature is also generating more thunderstorms and more lightning strikes, and therefore more sources of ignition. Because you're right, through this region that we've looked at is really sparsely populated. It's one of the lowest human population densities in the world. So it's not the ignitions do not come from people, although field surveys would also be needed to sort of verify this sort of this claim. But all signs tend to point to the fact that we do see more convective energy in the air. Particularly like around like June, end of June and July, and that's causing more ignitions and therefore more fires.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Our guest is Dr. David Gavo, expert forest analyst with harsh news from the Arctic. Earth crossed a tipping threshold in the far north.
Well, while I have you here, I know you have a lot of expertise on Indonesian forests and the loss of them. I understand Indonesian pulp and paper giant April has announced they will double production, but they say the additional fiber will come from their concessions and suppliers with no loss of intact rainforest. Can your system of mapping and satellites pick up whether that is true or not?
We're developing and maintaining a system, a monitoring system that detects, that monitors deforestation on an annual basis, going back 20 years, but also in near real time on a weekly basis. And we're looking at this deforestation in a number of concessions, whether they are oil palm or pulp and paper. April is one of the concession, one of the companies that we monitor, among others. It is fair to say that deforestation in these concessions has decreased quite dramatically in the last few years, just like it did overall in Indonesia. So in that sense, there's been much, much less deforestation. But when you look at the 20-year period, when you look at the amount of damage that April and its sort of and the other and APP, the two sort of largest players in the pulp and paper industry in Indonesia, they've caused a dramatic amount of deforestation, and particularly on peatlands, because we talked about peatlands earlier, but peatlands were pretty much left untouched until the early 1990s because naturally, peatlands are swamps. You don't, you know, it's not really conducive for agriculture. The soils are also very acidic. So to turn a peatland area into an agricultural farm is costly. You need to cut the forest. Okay, you can sell wood, that's good, but then you need to excavate, do drainage canals, quite a few of them. So you need to have heavy machinery with you. And then at the end of the day, the soils that you get, you know, well, they will still, you know, there will still be some flooding and at some point. But also the soil is acidic. So they're not great. And up until the 1990s, they were left on their own. But then ABB and April, precisely in the 1990s, pioneered the conversion of peat swamp forests to, well, mainly acacia and eucalyptus monoculture plantations through, mechanized clearing and so on. And this pioneering, they did this because they didn't want to have problems with communities around them because nobody used to go on those peat lands. But then the clearing opened roads and navigation waterways. And so as the years progressed, more and more people also obviously looking for land and more people were able to afford to rent heavy excavators and so on. Through farmers' associations and so on. So there's been a sort of, they've opened the floodgates to peatland conversion in Indonesia and the subsequent problems that were faced with fires, but also subsidence, flooding and so on. But it's fair to say that if they're telling you, okay, well, you know, we've done a lot of progress. We no longer have deforestation. We no longer clear the forests that are in our concessions. There's some truth in there. They've also, April has also acquired a number of restoration concessions. It's a concession, but it's not to clear the forest, it's to restore it, or at least to maintain it, to protect it. So they have that. They're very proud about that. But I think they should do more because we're talking hundreds of thousands of hectares that they've cleared to grow acacia and eucalyptus. And there's talks of more processing facilities and expansion and so on. I think they will have to be very careful because they've made these zero deforestation pledges and a lot of eyes are on those activities. There's been a bit of progress, but it's nowhere near enough compared to the damage that was done.
Well, getting back to the Arctic, what is the tipping point you and your colleagues warn about in the paper? Talk to us about the 10 degrees.
Right. Well, this is the observation that we made when we looked at the relationship between our burned area estimates annually since 1982 to 2020. And when we compared those burned area estimates with air temperature, with summer air temperature, sort of the average temperature for June, July, and August, but also against surface temperature and vapor pressure deficit and climatic water deficit and so on. When I go back to the air temperature, we did indeed find that the correlation was, there was a near exponential relationship between air temperature, but also surface temperature, and the amount of burning every year. So because it's near exponential, there's this, at one point, there's a sort of a threshold above which a small increase in temperature will generate a very large increase in burned area. And for air temperature, this threshold is 10 degrees. For surface temperature, this threshold is 17 degrees. That's what we observed. We observed that when a summer in the Siberian Arctic, on average, is above 10 degrees Celsius, we do see more fires. We start to see like an acceleration of fire activity. Only four times in 4 years that we've looked at did the summers surpass 10 degrees. And only four times in 2001. But then the last 3 years, 2018, 2019, and 2020, you see, what we're seeing is that, and what we're predicting is that in the future, more and more summers will be warmer than 10 degrees, and then we'll see more and more fires as a result. Now, I don't have the full understanding of what this 10 degrees mean biologically, you know, or biophysically at least. But what I could say is that temperature is driving a lot of different fire factors, like lengthening of the summer season, earlier snow melt, longer growing season. So what we also evidenced in the paper was that there was a greening of the Arctic in the last 40 years. More vegetation also means more fuel, more that can potentially burn. We also show that climatic water deficit was going up. In other words, plants are receiving less water through the roots than they need to be able to thrive because they have to give out too much through evapotranspiration, through this sort of vapor pressure deficit. And so that creates a climatic water deficit. Essentially, plants are stressed because they don't have enough water.
Your team uncovered a positive feedback loop where warming drives more fires that will bring more warming. I know it's a little early to say, but do you think additional greenhouse gases from Arctic wildfires could be big enough to speed up global warming the world over?
I think the risk is real for in the future because of so much peatlands that could, you know, essentially thaw and dry and burn. But when we look at the numbers currently, I think we were showing that, was it like between 150 and 200? I don't have the numbers on top of my head, but like around 200 million tons of CO2 equivalent were emitted into the atmosphere in 2020. That's a lot. It's about the emissions from a country like Spain in a year, but it's less than the estimates for emissions from peatland fires in Indonesia. In 2015, we measured, I was on a team of scientists who measured, quantified the carbon emissions from the 2015 fires. And the lead author was Huygen from a university in the Netherlands. And we found that in 2015, it was not 200 million tons of CO2 equivalent, but it was 1.2 billion tons of CO2 equivalent that was emitted, like five times more.
That's pretty worrying. So, David, as we wrap up here, could you tell us about the role of your website, thetreemap.com, that you founded?
Well, we have another website. It's called the Nusantara Atlas. It's a website that specializes in the monitoring of deforestation in near real time, but also fires, specifically in equatorial Asia. So we're looking at Indonesia, we're looking at Malaysia, and soon PNG, Papua New Guinea. It's called Nusantara Atlas. So it's got maps. It's a bunch of interactive maps. It's essentially bringing in satellite imagery, processed data on deforestation, but also a rich cadastral information into one space. And people are able to verify if there's deforestation in the concession and so on. We also have a blog section where we regularly post articles, stories, when we find something going on that we think people should know about. Like it could be positive news. Hey, we see that deforestation is declining in Indonesia. This is good news. It could be negative news where we say, oh, well, yes, but locally we do see increasing deforestation in a national park, for example. And so we try to keep people informed. This website is primarily for Indonesian NGOs who work in the field of forest conservation in Indonesia to sort of help anybody understand what happens on the ground, you know, to make sure that it is fair, transparent, and democratic. As the site is called Nusantara Atlas, we're hoping to be able to expand it into the future. In fact, we're now thinking of at least expand this to the sort of the Arctic region, where we could just monitor deforestation, you know, fires and deforestation, but primarily fires in near real time. But that's the sort of the main website. The Tree Map website is, I must say, I need to sort of rethink it because that was built 2 years ago in a rush after I came back from Indonesia. I was actually deported from Indonesia in 2020 before the pandemic in January for reporting burned area estimates in 2019 in Indonesia. They were double the official estimate. So I came back to my home country in France and I set up the company, The Tree Map, in a bit of a rush. I set up the website and I haven't done anything since.
Right. Well, I will get that new website from you and I will post it in my blog at ecoshock.org so listeners can find that. And we're all looking forward to the day when any of us can look at deforestation anywhere in the world and make sense of it so we can be a witness to what is happening here. We have been speaking with Dr. David Gaveau. He is co-author of the new paper, Unprecedented Fire Activity Above the Arctic Circle, Linked to Rising Temperatures. It's published in the journal Science on November 3rd. David, thank you for taking the time to speak with our listeners.
Well, thank you very much, Alex. It was a pleasure to be there and to be able to sort of explain a little bit what we did. And hopefully something's going to change, you know, with the global climate talks now taking place at COP27. I mean, there's a sense of urgency. We're seeing it all around us. Hot summers in Europe and so on. Now this thing in the Arctic. And so let's hope that some good decisions are going to be made at COP27 this week.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.